from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Thursday began with the news that Ukrainian security forces had killed three pro-Russian activists, wounded 13, and took 63 captive in a fight overnight in the eastern city of Mariupol, the most lethal clash so far in the east of the country. Reports then emerged later Thursday that Russia, the U.S., the EU, and Ukraine had adopted a joint document on the de-escalation of the crisis after talks in Geneva. It reportedly calls for all illegal armed groups to lay down their arms and a wide amnesty. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the document they drafted also calls for a, quote, immediate start of a nationwide national dialogue within the framework of the constitutional process, which must be inclusive and accountable, closed quote. He announced the agreement at a press conference Thursday.
We have approved a document. It's the Geneva Declaration of the 17th of April, where we agreed with the need to adopt the first practical steps to de-escalate the situation, to preserve the tension, the security for all the Ukrainians. We've agreed that all of the sides need to refrain from provocative actions, from intimidation, and we have condemned and rejected any acts of extremism, hatred, religious extremism, and intolerance. And this is a very relevant demand concerning what's happening in Ukraine. Among the steps that we are calling for are as follows. All the illegal armed forces need to lay down their arms, and all the seized buildings need to be handed over to their legitimate owners. All of the occupied streets, squares, and other public spaces in all of the Ukrainian cities and towns need to be freed. And there should be an amnesty for all the protesters announced, except for those who've committed grave crimes. And we also decided that to ensure the implementation of all of these measures, we are calling on a special monitoring mission of the OSCE, which is currently deployed in Ukraine, according to its mandate, which is to de-escalate tension. We call on this OSCE mission to play the leading role in assisting the Ukrainians themselves and the Kyiv authorities and the local communities across the Ukrainian regions to implement those de-escalation steps. And, of course, Russia, Ukraine, and the EU have been taking part in this mission, and the list of the members of this mission will expand, and we will support the activities of this mission, again, all of its efforts aimed at bringing the sides together so that step by step, based on mutual and reciprocal steps to de-escalate the situation. We're also issued a call for a massive, inclusive, nationwide dialogue as part of the constitutional process, something that should be inclusive, transparent, and accountable. So these are the three key characteristics which have been missing so far in the activities of the Verkhovna Rada, the Ukrainian Parliament's activities. And this dialogue should engage all of the Ukrainian regions, all of the political forces, and it should review all of the amendments to the Constitution that are being drafted. We're also talked about the importance of the economic situation, and we need to improve the economy of Ukraine, and we said that we'll be agreeing further steps to improve the Ukrainian economy as these de-escalation steps are implemented. So this is the essence of our steps, and this is a compromise of sorts, but what's most important to us is the acceptance of the fact that it's up to the Ukrainians to resolve this crisis. What I mean is that the immediate end of conflicts related to the arrests of protesters, the seizures of different administrative buildings and squares, and in the long term, the start of a full constitutional reform. Russia, as you know, when this meeting was still being prepared, we proposed that there should be the main opposition forces represented, the opposition forces that do not agree with what happened in Kiev in February, who have some doubts about the legitimacy of the Ukrainian authorities, but according to some reasons, it was not possible to invite the representatives of the opposition, in particular the representatives of the south and east of Ukraine. But we have distributed some of the documents which were passed by the Lugansk authorities and by the new movement of the southeast of Ukraine. These are documents on de-escalation of the situation, on avoiding any use of violence or force, and also this sets forth the vision of the Ukraine's future, as seen by the Southeast. It's all about decentralization. It's giving more power to the Ukrainian regions. They should be able to elect their own executive and legislative bodies, and also ensuring the Russian language is playing a decent role in the culture of Ukraine. Some say it should have official status. Some say it should be language status, but it's up to the Ukrainians, and it should be a mutually acceptable solution to all of the regions. We will assist those parties in achieving those goals, because this is the requisite for the stability of Ukraine. We need to make sure that cultural, historical, and linguistic features of this country are taken into account. We agreed that we'll be meeting further on in different formats, and we believe that our colleagues, which are now taking part in the OSCE mission in Ukraine, will heed our call, because we cannot do what the OSCE is supposed to do. This is just our call, and the OSCE needs to act on its mandate and resolve different hotbeds of tension, and we will try to make sure that this mission works in a transparent way, and it needs to focus on all of the aspects mentioned in our declaration, in particular the most important tasks of releasing protesters that took part in some political demonstrations, and Pavel Gubarev, the people's nominated governor of Donetsk. And also, we need to avoid any extremism.
But soon after the Geneva document was published, Ukraine's acting foreign minister, Andrei Deshitsa, reportedly said that Kiev was not bound by its terms. The acting foreign minister said it will not halt what it called anti-terrorist operations in the east of the country, saying, quote, "The troops in the east of the country are carrying out a special operation and can remain where they are," closed quote. That statement came after an earlier one issued by the acting Ukrainian foreign ministry following the meeting, which said that all sides had pledged to refrain from any form of violence, intimidation, or provocative actions. At his press conference, Lavrov was asked about the reported reversal.
Mr. Lavrov, Ukraine has announced partial mobilization efforts. And there are a lot of large number of troops on the Ukrainian border. And Mr. Putin said today that he hopes he will not have to invade Ukraine. If Ukraine doesn't conduct this constitutional reform as you view it, as Russia views it, will Russia insert its military forces into Ukraine? Well, as for the Russian servicemen, they are on our territory. As for your servicemen, well, you conduct your mobilization on your own territory. The only difference is that our servicemen are not used against our own people, and your military forces have been mobilized by an illegal order to suppress mass protests. As for Crimea, it has nothing to do with it. Crimea has made its choice, and we have accepted, recognized this choice. We have treated their vote with respect. We have not ramped up our troops. There is a Russian base, and there is the necessary amount of troops for its normal operations. If there are any reports that the number of troops has increased, it might have to do with the fact that the majority of troops of the Black Sea Fleet base, Ukrainians have decided to join the Russian forces. I would like to assure you that there are no additional excessive Russian troops on the Ukrainian or any other soils that would violate any international treaty. So there's none of that. As for your last question, I don't quite understand what you mean. We have no wish to insert our military forces into Ukraine, where our fraternal nation lives. It runs counter to the fundamental interests of Russia. We are deeply concerned with the discriminatory attitudes of the interim authorities towards the Russian-speaking people, towards the Russian culture, towards the Russian language. What we're hearing from Kiev, from the parliament in Ukraine, are outrageous statements. When members of the ruling coalition call those who speak the Russian language as creatures, and they said that they should be exterminated. This is one of the examples, just one of the examples. There have been many cases like that. And we have not heard any of the statements from the Russian coalition that would condemn calls and statements like that. So we proceed from the fact that we'll do anything we can to change the situation. The constitutional reform will take place, and our U.S. partners that have the most decisive impact on the Ukrainian authorities have assured us that that would happen. And we believe that this reform should be taken to the very end, and within it, the interests of all the minorities will be respected.
Earlier in the day, the Russian president also answered questions in a 3-plus-hour-long marathon with queries from people around Russia via telephone, emails, and video links. One question asked what the effects of the U.S. and EU sanctions against Russia would be.
If the West refuses to buy the gas from Russia, how will this affect the pensioners' revenues?
Oil and gas revenues are a big contribution to the Russian budget. It's a big part for us. When we decide on developing the economy, financing of our development programs, and of course, meeting our social obligations. Let me tell you this. I may be wrong in exact numbers. Let me try to remember that the main revenues out of oil and gas revenues come from oil, not gas. In dollar equivalent, last year the revenues from oil were $191-194 billion, from gas about $28 billion. Is there a difference? $191 billion from oil and only $28 billion from gas.
Ну, нефть, она продается на мировых рынках.
Is sold internationally at global markets. Can they hurt us here? Oh, they could try. Where it will, what it will lead to for those who would. Oh, of course, first of all, how to do that? To increase production and to decrease the prices in global markets. Only Saudi Arabia can do that. Saudi Arabia, their budget is calculated based on $85-90 per barrel. And if and our budget is calculated based on 90, I think. If we go below 85, Saudi Arabia will have problems with their budget. For us, the drop from 90 to 85 is not critical. That's one thing. Saudi Arabia is our partner. We have excellent relations with it. We have different approaches to Syria, but elsewhere we have situations that coincide. For example, our views on Egypt are very close, and I respect the king of Saudi Arabia, the keeper of two Muslim sacred places, shrines, and he is a very wise person. I don't think that our Saudi friends will hurt us and damage themselves and the economy of Russia. They are acting within OPEC, and there we have our allies. It's not that they like us, but they have their own economic interests, and they don't want to drop the production drastically, because that can only be done in OPEC together. That's quite a complicated thing. And in the U.S. themselves, the U.S., they develop the production of shale, oil and gas. The profitability there is not that high. Those are expensive products. And if you decrease the price in the global market, those will stop being profitable, will be making losses, and this emerging shale industry will die. Another idea. Oil is sold in dollars. If prices go down, then the demand for dollars will go down, and dollar will stop having its significance as a global currency. There are a lot of components here. They really want to bite us, but their opportunities are limited there, even though they could damage us somewhat, I guess. Now, what about gas, natural gas? We sell our pipeline gas. This is our most crucial sales. We sell gas to European countries, and 30-35% 34% of their energy mix is covered by supply from Russia. Can they stop buying Russian gas at all? I think it's impossible. Some of our neighbors, they are our good neighbors. We have excellent relations with Finland, let's say. But Finland, in their gas mix, they get 90% from Russia. In some countries of the so-called people's democracy, they get 50, 60, 70% of their gas coming from Russia. Can they stop buying from us altogether? I think it's utterly unrealistic. Will they damage when they make themselves bleed? I cannot imagine that. Of course, everyone wants to diversify the supply. They want to increase their independence of the Russian supplier. And we also begin to talk about this independence of our consumers, but everything is in balance between suppliers and consumers. There is only one problem here, those who transit our gas. And the transit through Ukraine is a problem. It's very difficult to agree or negotiate with them on energy But I hope even here we'll also get it to the required situation. I mean, the contracts that we've signed with them, and that should be working.
And Wednesday, Russia's UN Ambassador Vitaly Churkin challenged a report from a UN human rights inspector, which Churkin said was one-sided and politically biased. The inspector, Ivan Simonovic, is a former Croatian justice official who came to the UN back in 1997 when Croatia had seceded from Yugoslavia with U.S. backing.
The situation in the East, if not adequately addressed as a matter of priority, risks seriously destabilizing the country as a whole. Those who exercise influence over the situation should take immediate action to halt the violence. The arming of protesters and their transformation into quasi-paramilitary forces must be stopped.
Churkin took issue with the inspector's report.
Thank you so much, Madam President. The recent events in southeast Ukraine are of great concern. On April 13, having convened an emergency meeting of the Security Council, the Russian delegation called quite insistently upon a number of members of the Council to use all tools available to them to prevent the use of force in the crisis in the eastern regions of Ukraine. In response, we heard a number of ambiguous statements, and some delegations expressed their understanding for the plans of the Ukrainian authorities to use force against their fellow countrymen. Well, the result is clear. Those were as a result of the forcible coup. Usurp power in Kiev have chosen to ignore the legitimate demands of the inhabitants of the southeast and the unconstitutional use of armed force to pacify their own people, blasphemously referring to it as bandits and terrorists. Such callous steps are fraught with the risk of a real civil war in Ukraine. The first blood has already been shed. The citizens of the southeast repeatedly warn the authorities that they are ready to serve as human shields. In a number of regions, regular units of the Ukrainian army and internal forces openly objected to firing on their fellow citizens. There are cases where troops switched over to the side of the people. Is this perhaps why the self-appointed leaders in Kyiv are using fighters from the right sector and other illegal armed formations on whose heels they, in essence, came to power? For example, in Kramatorsk, individuals were deployed in black uniforms, individuals belonging neither to the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine nor to the internal forces. Whose command did these units heed? Of course, very few here can harbor any illusions regarding the independence of actions of Kyiv. This is where the question arises. Maybe Kyiv was advised to launch a scenario force by those countries whose high-level emissaries continue to whisper in the ears of the Ukrainian leaders. A recipe for extricating oneself from this large-scale crisis which has impacted Ukraine is both simple and complex at the same time. Ukrainians must launch a dialogue, ensuring that it is comprehensive and full-fledged in nature. All without any exception, regions and political forces in the country must participate in it on an equal basis, with equal rights in resolving pressing issues. All of this must be reflected in a deeply reformed constitution, one which would be seen by the multi-ethnic Ukrainian society as a sound one designed for the long term, to serve as a long-term basis for a legal government. Without this, it will be very difficult for Ukraine to preserve its unity and to resolve pressing issues on extricating itself from this crisis. This topic will be the main one at the Geneva meeting, which thus far remains on the agenda. This must also be the main objective of the international community when it speaks to its concerns regarding the events in Ukraine. One must now start a real rather than a cosmetic constitutional reform. Madam President, today it is extremely important to receive confirmed information on the situation in Ukraine. If the international forces there want to be present in the country, they must objectively in an unbiased way assess the situation and its developments. Unfortunately, the report of the UNHCHR, which was published yesterday, speaks to quite the opposite. This document, unfortunately, is biased in nature. Those who drew up the report chose not to notice that the current authorities in Ukraine became so as a result of an armed coup rather than civilized democratic elections. The attacks of illegal armed formations on the forces of law and order and the radical seizing of administrative buildings in the report are qualified as peaceful protests, quite surprisingly. The demonstrations of the citizens of Ukraine in the eastern reaches of the country, on the other hand, are deemed to be illegal actions. In the report, it is stated that the Ukraine government allegedly intends to leave behind the unfairness of the past and to elaborate a new vision for Ukraine's future. In this, unfortunately, a number of inconvenient facts are left aside, some which point to the fact that the activity of this government from the very start is based on an atmosphere of violence and which it itself has created. There is no attention paid to a very dangerous development, the growth of aggressive nationalism and neo-fascism. The term of neo-fascism is not used at all, in fact. The right sector and other ultra-radical groupings, chauvinism in the eastern Ukraine, merely states that the right or the participation of minorities in the political life of the country is not fully taken into account. Nothing is said regarding the calls for fanning the flames of national enmity and the destruction of the Russian-speaking population. The statements of the leader of the parliamentary party, Svoboda, on the liberation of Ukraine from the Moscow Jewish mafia. And if no one has heard this slang in the past, we're referring here to Russians and Jews. I would like to remind you that this individual, according to the Wiesenthal Center, is fifth in terms of the most blatant anti-Semites in Europe. And this party is currently in charge of the force ministries in Kiev. Those who call for the killing based on ethnicity are criminals. They must be immediately arrested and they must be brought to justice in accordance with international commitments of Ukraine, including in the field of human rights. And rather than to create the skeleton of a national guard and the current leading elite, despite the fact that in the report the Ukrainian society is quite fairly described as bilingual, the real situation of the Russian-speaking population in the country is not reflected rightly. So sometimes the Russian-speaking population are referred to as people who are not full-fledged citizens and so forth. The harassment by radicals on physical violence against the representatives of the former authorities and those who do not agree with the current regime continues. Recent examples. On the 7th of April, a number of participants of the meeting of justices were harassed during the night of April 15th. The headquarters of the Communist Party of Ukraine, the Party of Sum, was attacked. Unfortunately, the participants of the current Kiev regime were not referred to in the report. Instead of this, there are references to a number of anonymous witnesses who saw something somewhere or perhaps heard something. What also doesn't stand up to the facts are the assessment of the situation with freedom of speech and freedom of the media, as if there are no continued attempts by the Ukrainian authorities to prevent objective light being shed on the situation in the country, threats and intimidation of journalists, and refusing to issue visas to foreign journalists and representatives of the media. Concerns regarding the current situation were heard not only by eminent NGOs, including Reporters Sans Frontières and the Committee of the Protection of Journalists, but also the European Commission. What type of human rights and rule of law can one refer to if there are attacks which are carried out even on candidates for the presidency of Ukraine, Oleg Tsareva and Mikhail Dobkin? And the Rada has finally been turned into a type of kulak democracy. As far as the UNHCHR's reports and Mr. Simonovich's unfounded inventions regarding the situation in Crimea is concerned, Crimea, which is, of course, a subject of the Russian Federation, well, in principle, they cannot serve as the subject for discussion during today's meeting devoted to the situation in Ukraine. And they're not worthy of such discussion. The impression is being created that the report is fabricated to reach predetermined conclusions. This political tone was set by Mr. Simonovich in his statements following his first visit to Ukraine in March. On the whole, we are forced to note that the report undermines trust in the work of the UNHCHR as an unbiased defender of human rights. We will continue to closely follow the work of the UNHCHR's mission, and we will look at how its future reports will reflect the violence in southeast of the country unleashed by the so-called authorities in Kyiv. We advise all those who, not just in words but in actions, champion human rights in this country to devote special attention to the actions of Kyiv's self-proclaimed authorities, which threaten to pacify the east and southeast of the country by force, which is fraught with mass violations of human rights, first and foremost aimed against the Russian and Russian-speaking population of these regions.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.